The Mormon Expression Podcast is made possible through the support of our listeners. Consider making a donation or purchasing a subscription today at mormonexpression.com. The books you hear discussed on the podcast and others that we recommend can be purchased by clicking on the store link. And to those of you who have already contributed, thanks.
All right, welcome back to another edition of Mormon Expression. I'm your host, John Larson, and tonight we're going to bring you another in our long and tiresome series of Dummies podcasts, and tonight we're going to talk about the one and only Church Handbook of Instruction, the secret, nay, sacred document that governs the church. Isn't that right, Mike? Sacred?
Sacred.
Yeah. So tonight we have a sort of full panel. First of all, we're joined by, as I just pointed out, the one and only Mike. How are you doing tonight, Mike?
I'm doing good.
And we're also joined by the intrepid Zilpha. Hi, Zilpha.
Hello.
We're joined tonight by two special guests, two individuals who've not been with us before. First of all, we have Gail. How are you doing, Gail?
I'm doing well. I'm glad to be here.
And we also have Eliza R. Snitch.
Hi. Glad to be on.
Okay. So why don't you each take a little bit and introduce yourselves and who you are. Eliza, why don't you start us out? You're the one with the church requisite middle initial.
With my nom de plume. And I take my middle initial pretty seriously in real life, too. I was born in the church, born in Salt Lake City. We moved to Alaska when I was a kid, and so I was raised in Alaska. After I graduated, I went to BYU, and that's where I kind of lost my way, I think my parents would say. And so I've been out of the church 5 years, and I'm back in Alaska.
Never been happier, right?
Right, of course.
Well, welcome to Mormon Expression. And Gail.
Thank you.
Maybe let us know about yourself.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm born and raised in Utah. I was born in the Covenant. I did all the normal things, you know, deacons, quorum president, first assistant in the priest quorum. I served a mission in the Philippines to the Philippines Ilagan mission. So I speak Tagalog. Not that it does me much good these days. Even did a little stint as a veil worker at the temple when I got back. So back in Utah, but I lost my faith. I guess going through my crisis of faith last year, and been slowly working to kind of come out and be more open about who I am.
Well, you're welcome here.
Thank you, sir.
Well, thanks for joining us, guys. Like I said, we're going to talk a little bit tonight about the Church Handbook of Instruction. And this book is one that's well known to some inside the church, and surprisingly enough, probably not known by others. The Church Handbook of Instructions is actually divided into two books, Book 1 and Book 2. Book 2 is widely distributed to auxiliary leaders. Of course, women, anything women do is an auxiliary to the church. And young men's leaders and that sort of thing. And Book 1 is restricted. It is only given to select individuals. Surprisingly enough, those who are restricted from are even high officials in the church, like the High Council. If you're a High Councilman, you are not allowed to have a copy of Book 1. We, of course, have a copy, and we'll be happy to talk to you about it tonight. Mike, how did you get a copy?
Through your evil links. You linked me to WikiLeaks.
Mike, you're a
where,
nice boy.
They have the old version and the new version.
Yes.
And I got the newest version and read through that.
And it's long, right?
Yes, it was long.
You read the whole thing, Mike?
I did.
I read the whole thing. John yells at me if
wow.
I don't. So. But I did skip over things like maintaining church property. How to take care of the church cleaning and things. I skipped over that.
I skipped over the priesthood organization part.
All right. So let's talk about what is in the book. Well, first, before we go there, let's talk about the book itself. I wasn't joking when I said that it's restricted, and it has had a long history of restriction. Namely, there have been lawsuits, one that has been very, very important and has gone to the higher courts. Did it go all the way to the Supreme Court? Does anybody know? The lawsuit I'm referring to is Intellectual Reserve versus the Utah Lighthouse Ministries of 1999. Now, Intellectual Reserve, for those who don't know, is the legal entity. It's a corporation that's owned by the church, and they own all of the text and manuals. So it's not actually the church that owns, say, the text or the copyright on the Book of Mormon or the Church Handbook of Instruction. It is Intellectual Reserve that controls all those. And Utah Lighthouse Ministries, a well-known ministry inside Salt Lake City run by the late Gerald Tanner and Sandra Tanner, who have been well involved in publishing all sorts of stuff, historical documents, and, you know, there we could go into that history. But what it was in 1999 on their lawsuit, Utah Lighthouse Ministries, they linked from their website to a website that was somewhere in Europe or somewhere outside of the domain of the United States Copyright Office to a copy of the 1998 text of the Church Handbook of Instructions. This lawsuit went way up high into the courts. I'm not sure if it went all the way to the Supreme Court or not. And Utah Lighthouse Ministries lost, setting important precedents for people who are tracking things on the internet about deep linking, that actually putting a link to the text that is copyrighted, of course the text is copyrighted, can be an actual infringement of copyright law, which is why you will not find a link to the text which is on WikiLeaks from my website.
John, I just checked it and actually went up to the United States District Court. That's how I went
up. The District Court. So it did go up. Now, the church has had a long history suing people over the smallest things. And as you know from our podcast with Tom Kimball a couple weeks ago, we talked about some of those things with Signature Books. But, you know, one that comes to mind directly is the little coffee shop in 2007 called Just Add Coffee that had a T-shirt that had an angel, looked like the angel Moroni with a big trumpet, and there was somebody pouring coffee into the trumpet. And the church sued or threatened lawsuit on copyright infringement, although the church has never been able to show that they have a copyright on an angel with a trumpet, nor do I think they could get that copyright, but that doesn't stop them from suing. So the church has had long and strong strong-arming tendencies when it comes to keeping this sort of stuff in the family.
Why is it that it's so restricted to only the stake presidents and bishops, basically? Why don't they give it to every member?
My impression is that by explaining to bishops and things that the scope of their authority and the things they can do to help members, when you all the information's out, you get people abusing that same system as opposed to using it to help themselves. It's like people
on
welfare.
So the way it
welfare.
Is now, sorry.
I was going to say, it's the church welfare can be mishandled and abused the same way people abuse government welfare. They find the best way to work the system where they can get the most out of it and like that. That's the impression I get, is why they'd want some of this stuff secret.
You know, there are a lot of aspects in there, though, that, you know, it says specifically that individuals should counsel with their bishop concerning this matter, but the individuals would never know that in advance without consulting with the bishop. And so how are they supposed to know which matters really, really, you know, require that you go to the bishop to talk about it or counsel with him, because they're ignorant of the book and the instructions?
It's probably just something that would come up during the meeting. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
You're not going to have like a sports team play a game and not let them know what the rules are. So I don't think it's fair to have to expect people to dedicate their lives to a church and not know how it's run.
Well, most people will. I mean, if John hadn't linked this to me, I would never lay eyes on this, because there's nothing in it that concerns me, unless there's a case of emergency, in which case I go to my bishop anyway. You know, there's no reason for general members to ever even have to look at the book, because it doesn't have anything really that concerns them.
But there are
a lot
of things that could.
And if they're not being treated fairly by their leaders,
they wouldn't know.
If you want to do anything in terms of fertility treatment, or if you're having difficulties with that, for example, I mean, if you're going to consider in vitro fertilization, or if you want to have a surrogate mother, or if you, you know, exercising, a lot of these things, the handbook tells you that these are things you're supposed to counsel together as a couple, but also with your bishop, and there are specific, you know, preferences the church has laid out within the handbook of instructions that individuals will be ignorant of unless they happen to ask the right questions to their bishop. So, you know, being blind to it certainly doesn't help anyone unless you run everything past your bishop, and I don't think that's healthy or wise.
Hey, Mike. So I'll grant you that argument, the one you made originally, which is that there are things in this book that if members had access to, they could potentially abuse. I agree with that. There are things in here that you could use to manipulate your bishop. However, I think the opposite is true also. If the membership does not have access to the book and does not know what the policy is, that puts ecclesiastical leaders, especially those on the front line, stake presidents and bishops, in a position of potential abuse over the membership, because they can act in ways that are not sanctioned by the church, and the membership has no recourse. If you do not have the handbook of instruction, there is no avenue in the church to say, Bishop Smith, that's not allowed. You're outside the domain of what a bishop can do.
I think if you're on the fringes of the church, that might be true. But a lot of the wards I'm in have like two former bishops in the chapel. You have the stake presidency visiting all the time. I mean,
let's use a simple example, Mike, to see what I'm talking about. Suppose my bishop calls me in and says, "Brother Larson, we notice that you don't have enough children. As your bishop, I am telling you that you need to have more children. According to the church handbook of instruction, the bishop cannot tell a couple that they can have more children." Now, in the scenario that you're giving, how would I have any recourse against my bishop at all? How would I even know that he's violating church policy?
You're probably going to leave that office and call your friend and go, "Can you believe what he just told me?"
Yeah, but your friend wouldn't know either.
The friend's not going to know unless he's a bishop.
The bishop doesn't have to be acting, you know, out of malice. I mean, they could be really believing what they're doing is the right thing, but they can act out of ignorance. I mean, I was a ward clerk in my last ward, and very frequently in various meetings, you know, there were things that would come up, and I say, "You know what, Bishop, that's not correct. You know, the actual policy of the church is this, or the actual, you know, the instruction on this is this." You know, there's some very simple things that he was ignorant of, and I don't blame him. This is a big book full of lots of little details that he's not going to be fully aware of. And so I think having the information more widely available would actually be an aid to a bishop. I mean, there's a lot of weight on that position.
Yeah. I don't think all bishops are going to sit down for 4 hours like I did and go through every single sentence in this manual and take notes. And I mean, I'm sure there are plenty out there who will, but not all of them. A lot of them will just kind of skim, or they'll say, "Well, I'll look that up if it becomes an issue." But then, how will they know that what's in there unless they've read it all?
Yeah, you know, because there isn't any formal training for a bishop. When you're called, it's not like they send you to Salt Lake for a 3-month boot camp or anything like that. So there is a problem that, and I'm sure any of us who've been in the church long enough have seen bishops and stake presidents make mistakes. It happens all the time. I don't blame them for that. That's not necessarily a bad thing. But the problem that I've had with, and that the church handbook reflects in the church, is there is no check and balance in the church on local authority. There is no avenue of appeal. There is no avenue, if they're doing something incorrectly or doing something wrong, there is no way for the membership to appeal a decision
or to even know that they're doing something that the church says they shouldn't.
Right. If they follow the letter of the law and they do not distribute this book, it's potential that the membership wouldn't even know.
Of course, we should bring up that members can look at the book with the bishop in his office with the bishop present.
And how do you know that, Zilpha?
Because I read can the they?
Book. Because yeah, it's in the
it's
book.
In the book.
Yeah, they can.
But members wouldn't know that. Because it's in the
I was looking now, for that section. I couldn't find it in the book.
Yeah, it's there.
Is if it? You suspect now, your bishop is doing something wrong, you're not going to feel comfortable going into his office and looking it up in the book while he's there with you.
I don't believe you. Let me.
And he might be dismissive.
Now we're talking as if everything, and we've already used some examples of the most salacious stuff out of the book, which of course we'll talk about. But I want to point out that in my reading of the book, there are some of these things that are very, very interesting. I think that the first section on church leadership, which defines the roles of a stake president and a bishop and the first presidency and the area authority, is fascinating, and it's much clearer than anything that's written in the Doctrine and Covenants. The entire membership of the church should be studying the first couple chapters on church governance, because it lays out things on how the church actually runs. And it is something that everybody should know. And I think it should just be distributed.
Now, John, you notice
from here to the Gospel Principles Manual. Sorry, Mike.
I was going to say, you notice throughout that whole section, it keeps referring to the section of the Doctrine and Covenants where they got that from.
Yes.
So all this stuff is in the scriptures.
Well, it's true,
it lays it out better here.
Absolutely. It's in plain English. And of course, the Doctrine and Covenants, you know, we've changed the church since then. So this has the modern updates. And there are frankly things in here that is a real question that are on par with scripture, but there's no provenance behind it. We don't know where it came from, you know, that if it was.
And also, in regards to checks and balances, it tells you who's over what office. So if you have a problem with one office, you can go to the office above that and talk to them.
Yeah. If you read the book, you would know that.
Oh, general members know that a stake president's higher than a bishop.
Yeah, but what?
That's where about where my knowledge president? Stopped off there. I had no idea who to talk. Well, I didn't ever need to, but I had no idea who to talk to after the stake president.
How do you identify your area presidency? How do you know that there is an area presidency or what the area is?
Yeah.
Is there a site on the church website that tells you about the areas of the church? I'm not familiar.
I don't remember.
Probably is, but I'm not sure.
Yeah, you know, if you think about it in the abstract, it's really quite strange, because the church is very governance oriented, very, you know, the priesthood and the line of the priesthood, and everybody knows the top. Everybody knows their bishop and stake president. And then it gets really fuzzy, you know, in between there. And I doubt, can anybody here tonight name their area authority? Or who does their stake president answer to? Mike, do you know?
I don't know.
I don't know
his name.
I have no idea. The only time I knew who the area authority was when I was a missionary, and I knew who our area authority was, because every once in a while, the mission president would throw him under the bus and blame him for some policy.
Or he came to speak to us on the mission, and we all got hammered for not, you know, being all we should be.
Oh, yeah, that guy came and talked to you too, huh?
Well, one of them came and talked to us and you know, read us the riot act, and the next one came and was our best friend, and it was very interesting.
Yeah, I was in the San Diego mission, and we had a new area authority came in a year before we did, and everybody knows that during the 80s, the missionaries would all go to the Holiday Bowl. Well, this area authority stopped that and wouldn't let us go to the Holiday Bowl anymore, so we couldn't go to the San Diego Stadium and cheer as missionaries.
You couldn't even wear your uniforms and go? You had to keep your name tags on?
No, we weren't allowed to go at all.
I got to go to a jazz concert, but you know, we didn't have our uniforms on with our name badges.
Gail, go ahead.
You know, for me, actually, ironically, in my mission, that was when I first came across the Handbook of Instructions. I had a overly ambitious senior companion in my first area who took a copy from the branch presidency and said, "This is the missionary's copy," wrote it in big black marker inside the front cover and put it inside our apartment. I knew it was wrong, but I was so curious. And I sat down, and over the next week, I read the whole thing. It was fascinating, but I felt really guilty doing it, but I felt, you know, this is stuff I should know, and I was a missionary, and it was a weak branch that really needed the help of the missionaries, but, you know, those are the extent, you know, the lengths we had to go to help.
Well, you know, we had one. We weren't on my mission. We were helping out a branch, and there was the branch presidency and all that sort of stuff. We had one also, and I don't think there was anything negative about that at all. I mean, that I find the policy to be frankly overzealous, and I really think that most of the membership would do well. All the membership should read this book from cover to cover. You know, if you want to be a Mormon and know how the Mormon church works, this is the book that you turn to that defines everything and explains how it goes. And I don't see any problem at all with wide distribution.
John, have you ever had to deal with the welfare organization of the church and dealing with the low-income housing areas and the people that get the free food from the church? And
Yes, I have, but a lot of the policies for that are not specifically outlined in this book. They are in general, but there is a whole other auxiliary manual that deals with that. Yeah. And I don't think, you know, you need to get into all that, but I don't think it should be secret. I mean,
people who are going to play that kind of system are going to find a way to do it. Keeping this book away from the membership for that reason isn't a good enough reason, you know, that you think, you know, people are going to try to get around the system.
And Mike, I've...
And if that's an issue, then, you know, make the welfare portion of it, that can stay secret, and then, you know, the rest of it should be available to the general membership.
Well,
Go ahead, John.
Well, I've read the welfare stuff, and I've been involved with that, and most of it, the church rightfully says this is at the discretion of the bishop or the Relief Society president. So, you know, even if you had that, it wouldn't necessarily tell you how to game the system, because they still rely on the bishop making the call in terms of distribution of, say, cash versus, you know, food and that sort of stuff. The thing that it says in the Church Handbook of Instructions is, you know, you should not pay cash whenever possible, and instead let them pay their bills and let the church provide food and other material goods. Well, I mean, that doesn't help you game the system. If anything, it tells you, it discourages you from trying to get money from the church.
True. I think part of it, too, is you don't want a bunch of members playing Monday morning quarterback over what Bishop did on Sunday.
Ah, they do it anyway.
Yeah, but anybody that's actually involved in the church and doing their callings, you know, is going to get to know all this stuff on their own without even ever having to read the manual.
That's true.
You know what I'm saying?
Wouldn't it be more effective if they read the manual first and took a quiz, you know, rather than learn it through Hard Knocks? And then basically, yeah, I got the book too when I was a clerk. For some reason, ward clerks are allowed to have the book, but the High Council is not. And it was fascinating to read through it and find out how things were supposed to work, you know?
Yeah, let me read you one quote.
And you see the church in a different light after you've read it.
Yeah, not necessarily in a bad light, you know?
No. But you see how the mechanics work and how it's supposed to operate, and things start to make sense to you, why things happen the way they do, because there are these policies and these procedures behind the scenes that you might not be privy to unless you get the peek at the book.
Yes.
What's your quote, Mike?
I went and questioned a couple of the bishopric and stake presidency today that were in the ward, how the church handbook helped them. A member of the High Council, that former member of bishopric, said, "The book gave me confidence. If I didn't know the answer to an organizational question, it was in the handbook. The section I used the most often was the section on callings and releases, which leaders have the authority to issue which calling, like who has the authority to call who to what position." That's the one he used the most.
Yeah.
A counselor in the bishopric said one example of how it's helped him was when he does sustainings from the stand, releasing and callings. He says, I photocopied it out of the manual, and then I could just put the person's name in the blank and make sure I said the right things when I was releasing and calling people. Yeah. So he had the proper words in front of him for doing that.
Already?
What's that?
He doesn't have that memorized already? I mean, because it's just like one sentence.
Perhaps when he was new. Perhaps he was new at the time.
Perhaps.
That's the example he gave. He said there were hundreds, but that's the one that sprung to his mind when I questioned him.
Say, any opposed by the same sign? That kind of thing?
Yeah, but there's like three or four different ones you say. The stake president said it kept him focused on the order of business. It helped him to arrange affairs. It helped him in disciplinary councils. And he described the entire book as a whole as a scaffolding. It was something he could operate from and work off of, and gave a framework to how he's supposed to do his job as a stake president.
Yes, it certainly doesn't have all of the answers in here.
What's that?
It does not have all of the answers in here. A lot of times they say, you know, for the bishop to decide or for the member to decide, even though it's discouraged, it should still be left
firm and fast.
should still be left up to the individual to decide.
Well, that's what he was saying. The book itself is a framework, but you are supposed to work some things by the Spirit and just do what you know is right.
Right.
And the book itself is a framework.
That's when problems happen.
We can.
But I would agree that the book is very helpful, especially to people in these leadership positions, because they don't have a lot of training in advance. It's not a boot camp for, you know, these high profile positions. And so I think the book is very valuable, certainly. But it's just that it'd be better if it was available to more people. I mean, even within, if you look at, for example, at the distribution for the bishopric, you get 4 copies, which is kind of ironic because you have the bishop, his 2 counselors, an executive secretary, a ward clerk, and possibly a couple of assistant clerks who all should have access to the book. So you have like 6-7 people who should be able to access book 1, but you only have 4 copies.
Hey, you know,
which
I was
kind of ironic. I mean,
go ahead. No,
I was just going to say, ironically, you know, when I was in my last ward, sometimes in the middle of the day, I would be at work at my office. I get a phone call from the bishop and he'd have a question for me. Like, you know, what's this? Like, well, I don't have the book. I don't have permanent access to it. I only have it in the clerk's office. So I'd go online and get the illicit copy and find the answer he needed and then get back to him and say, this is what you're looking for. You know, and that's so strange because if we had more copies, this wouldn't be as big a deal.
Yeah, I was in the distribution center. You know, now in Utah, they're attaching the distribution centers to the Desert Industries. And I was walking around looking to see what was interesting. And they had them up behind the checkout stand displayed, you know, prominently where you display like a new release, like teasing us all.
No.
That it was there. It was up there behind the where you could see it. And I, you know, I thought about, you know, distracting them. You know, like using the force to have them look over here, then I could get a copy, but I didn't, and leave a dollar on the, you know, stand or whatever it cost, but I didn't do it. No, I want to be clear also. I agree with Gail. I think this book is great. It's well organized. It's well written. It's very clear. And I think every member, you know, the next year they should have this as the adult Sunday school manual and go through it section by section because it is a valuable book.
That'd be fascinating.
There are some things about the church that it exposes that I think can be kind of embarrassing to the church, and that's probably where we're going to go next in the discussion. I think to start that discussion off, I think the book exposes how legalistic the church is. I'm staring right now at the section on procedure when an ordinance is not valid, and man, oh man, you know, the LDS idea that the ordinance has actual specific meaning and not just meaning to the person is really made clear here. And, you know, for example, in the Church Handbook of Instructions, if I am a bishop and they have lost, somebody in the church has lost my baptismal record from 50 years ago and they can't find it, and there's not any witnesses, the first presidency themselves, those 3 old men, have to validate each and every ordinance that I've had since then, which seems to me to be utterly impossible that the first presidency could respond to that sort of stuff. That's just an example.
What page are you on?
I'm looking at page 31 of the 2006 edition.
Does it answer in there? I don't have this section printed out, but does it answer the question, which was brought up today by a friend I was talking to, a friend of theirs baptized their child at a time that they... Oh, no. It wasn't a friend of theirs. Okay, let me start again. Okay. It was a guy in the church who was later convicted of molesting his children. But in the meantime, during all that time, he had baptized his children. Do those children need to be rebaptized? Because they were baptized by someone who obviously was not worthy.
I know the answer to that. Do any of you want to take a first swipe at it?
I know the answer. I just don't know where the reference is for it.
I don't know if there is a reference. Is there, John?
I can't remember if it's in the book here. It came about because of Richard Lyman. And y'all know Richard Lyman is the most recent apostle to be excommunicated. He was excommunicated in 1946. The problem came about that he had a polygamous wife that he'd had for at least 20 years. Well, you've got a problem in the church once you find out that an apostle for 20 years has been in a state of apostasy, right? So the church's ruling is that even though you can be in a state of apostasy, all of your ordinances stand clear. And this just validates my point I was making about the church being bizarrely legalistic on some things. I mean, that makes zero sense at all.
Yeah, that doesn't
make sense. If they can't find a paper that said I was baptized, I'm not baptized, but I can be bonking a second wife and, you know, setting up wards and stakes and ordaining bishops and all that stays valid. You know, that's just ridiculous. But I mean, that's the church handbook instruction.
Well, you got to look at it this way, though. The man using the priesthood, it's not his priesthood. He's just a worker. And the person who the ordinance needs to ratify itself on is the one receiving the ordinance.
So why do they
so he's just a tool.
That you have to be worthy to hold the priesthood.
Well, I think it's good that the church, you know, it doesn't penalize the person receiving the ordinance just because the person giving it fouled up. It's not their fault that, you know, the person who baptized them or whatever else, you know, was leading a sinful apostate life. So I think that's good, but it does draw into question, like, what really matters here. And I guess it really matters is that there is a proper chain of authority, whether or not worthiness is applicable, and that it's done in the proper manner and documented. That's what it's like John was saying, it's the legalistic aspects. Yeah, it's that everything is in order, whether or not it's all clean.
You guys are all talking very rationally, but that's not the way the Church Handbook of Instruction approaches this thing. You're giving very, very good nuanced answers, but the Church Handbook of Instruction does not have room for that sort of nuance.
I was going to add that the worthiness of the priesthood bearer would work more towards whether or not he's going to be damned for mocking God by acting in his name when he's unworthy. That is more about that individual's salvation than it is his right to operate in the priesthood, if you know what I mean.
You can still use the power of the priesthood when you're a bad person.
But it damns that individual using it. It doesn't damn the individual that he's working, performing ordinances for.
So bad men can use the priesthood power, but good women can't.
I think this discussion is fascinating, the whole question of how the church even falls into apostasy if all this is true is another question. But let's steer back to the Church Handbook of Instruction. So we started to kind of talk about some of the things in there. So as you all read through the book, what is the most surprising things to you in the Handbook of Instruction? What as you look through it sort of took you aback?
I was surprised by the number of things that have to be approved by the First Presidency or the Quorum of the Twelve.
Yes, I had that one written down too.
Those guys they Amen. Must be up to their ears in paperwork.
See, I read it another way.
It's the office of the First Presidency, though. The three men don't see any of it, I'm sure.
I agree with what Gail's saying.
Okay.
I read that, and I worry sometimes about the shadow church. You know, you go downtown, there's that 37-story building of God knows who's in that building and who knows what they're doing, right? You know, we can see the guys in the red chairs, but since so many things in this book have to go to First Presidency for approval, there's no way those three old duffers who, if you look at the history of the church for the last 50 years, most of the time, at least one, possibly two, are incapacitated, you know, mentally or physically. So, you know, you're functioning on mm-hmm. one or two of those guys for most of the history of the church recently. There's no way they can do everything that's in this book. So who's doing it?
How do you define general?
That's authority? A good question.
Who are the general authorities? Like when it mentions general authorities in the handbook, how is that defined?
The general authorities are the 12, the First Presidency, and the 70.
So it wouldn't be your area president.
The First Quorum of 70.
The area authorities right now, I mean, it's church governance changes all the time. The area authorities right now are all 70.
They are general authorities?
They are right now.
Oh, because
some of them are.
Sure, that the members of
it depends on which Quorum of the 70 they come from.
They're discouraged from making phone calls or writing letters about doctrinal issues or personal matters. So there really is no recourse after the stake president.
Yeah, this is one that I've joked about before, that they always, and they send out a letter about once a year to the membership. Of course, it's in the Church Handbook of Instruction that says, do not write letters to the general authorities. And they oftentimes say in the letter, we will send those unopened to your stake president, which of course, as Zilf is pointing out, leaves you no recourse. But also, the funny thing is every time in conference, one of those guys always gets up and reads, here's a letter I received from somebody. So they don't obey their own rule.
I write them letters.
You wrote them letters? Did they ever respond?
No. No. I think I've only written one or two, and no, they don't respond. And I haven't heard from about them either. So, you know, maybe they got lost in the mail. I don't know.
I do. I have to admit, then, I have two or three people I know of who've written general authorities letters who've had them answered. So they do read and answer some of them. I guess it's if you get it to the right place.
I'm sure they're filled out to a secretary first.
See, that's a newer rule because Joseph Fielding Smith famously used to answer doctrinal questions all the time in the 50s.
Yeah, they say with the ever-increasing church membership, responding personally to these inquiries presents an almost insurmountable task.
Yeah, now that the church is global, that'd be pretty tough.
Yeah, yeah.
I agree, it would be difficult.
My problem is what if your stake president is giving you problems?
That's the problem. There's no path for recourse. There's no mechanism by which you can raise it that extra level if necessary. You just have to kind of accept what the local leaders say and do.
Well, there's regional reps. There's 70. There's a lot of stuff before you get to the first presidency.
But they didn't say don't write to the first presidency. They say don't write to the general authorities of the church.
Oh, but Mike, you have to remember, a lot of these things, they say that, issues like if there's someone who had murdered someone in the past and they need to be considered for baptism, or on and on the list of issues, the first presidency has to go to the first presidency for that. So the bishop and the stake president have to raise it all the way to the stake to the first presidency. They skip the 70s, the area presidencies, the quorum of the 12. It goes straight up to the top three.
One of the things you find in this book is when you do come up on all these problems you're talking about, they have phone numbers and addresses right to this building. Like the Research Information Division, if you need to research your line of authority, things like that. There's all kinds of phone numbers and addresses and places to write to get answers that you need.
That's true.
All for a lot of them, but there are also a lot of issues for which you have to go to the first presidency. So I have to assume that there's this Church Handbook of Instructions, Book 1, but there's got to be like a special Handbook of Instructions, Book A, for all the people in the office of the First Presidency, answering all of the rest of the questions, like how do we actually treat all these issues that keep coming to us?
Yeah, interestingly enough, Michael Quinn addressed that issue in Extensions of Power, the second book, and he came to the conclusion that they didn't because they kept reviewing and making the same decisions over and over again, and that they had gone back sometimes through the notes and noticed that. Maybe they have changed that now, but he pointed out that at least for a while in the church, there wasn't such a repository of information that you would expect. And that, that probably comes from the idea of reliance on revelation. But, there you go.
Yeah, you notice at the tail end of the book, it's all the... Go ahead.
You go ahead.
I was going to say, you notice that the tail end of the book is all the little miscellaneous questions that you might have, like, what were some of them?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
The
last part of the church is called, the book, the chapter 19 is called Church Policies. And there is a abbreviated section of this in book 2 that is generally distributed. And that's where a lot of the interesting things we're probably going to talk about. But before we start tying into those, I did want to point out there is a section, section 13, I think it was. No, section 7. It's the title of the section is Meetings. That sucker is 15 pages long. 15 pages of meetings. Reading through that just makes you tired.
A lot of it's in table form, right?
There are so many meetings. It is unbelievable how any like stake can function under the weight of the structure. Oh my gosh!
I feel bad for the stake president. That's tough. You look through the meetings he has to attend.
I feel bad for him just for that stake administration section. I mean, have you read through that? I mean, for him to keep track and actually do all the things it says he's supposed to do, it's a full-time job.
Yeah,
it's more than a full-time job. Same for the bishop.
Well, and
I think the way they break it down,
that
Eliza, go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to say that I thought it was interesting that the stake president is the one who is sort of in charge of the patriarch, and only the stake president is meant to talk to the patriarch about what he does, and only the stake president is supposed to make suggestions regarding the content of the blessing. I thought that was interesting.
Just to review them and make sure they're all appropriate.
Make sure that the patriarch
is
a little baddie.
Yeah.
Or he's not trying to tell people that they're going to see the second coming or something.
Yeah, we talked a little bit a minute ago about how much stuff went to the first presidency. One thing that's clear in this book, and probably it goes beyond the discussion here, but I'm going to bring it up anyway. There are two power seats in the church, and everybody else has been sort of eliminated out of the power structure. The 70, they're not worth anything. They can't do anything. The only two real powerful positions in the church are a stake president, who has an amazing amount of power. Bishops actually don't have that much authority.
A lot of responsibility. A
lot of responsibility, not that much authority. And then the first presidency, even the 12 are very limited. The first presidency controls all the nominal power, but the stake president is the other position, as you read through this book and find out, that can make a lot of decisions.
What about mission presidents?
Mission presidents have power in their own right. They're sort of on par with the stake president. And sometimes they have a little bit more, but it's sort of just about there.
Now, John, it's broken up into stewardships. The bishop is in charge of Aaronic priesthood, which handles worldly matters. So the bishop's job is not the spiritual welfare like the Melchizedek priesthood deals with. It's Aaronic. And that's why you might think he doesn't have as much power as
he thinks. Well. He's a high priest. Yeah, but not, he's allowed to preside over the ward and over the spiritual matters of the ward. That's
true, but he's also the head of the Aaronic priesthood for the in general terms. It's the stake presidency that deals with the spiritual welfare more so than the bishop. So it might appear that he has more power in that sense.
Yeah, yeah. And this is something, Mike, that it's a good point, and it comes very clear when you read the book, that there is a teacher's quorum president, but there's not a priest quorum president, because the priest quorum president is the bishop. There's also an elder's quorum president, but there's not a high priest quorum president, because the presiding high priest is the bishop. You're right. But I think in terms of that real sort of making monetary decisions and, you know, for example, in the Church Handbook of Instructions, the one who's authorized to go talk to the press is the stake president. It's not the bishop. So I think the stake president executes a lot more power than the bishop does.
I'll say the one thing I found surprising that I didn't know about was how wards are organized. I didn't realize you need this many active tithe-paying Melchizedek priesthood holders, and that's what determines the ward boundaries and how large a ward is. And those
you're right. Now say those two things again. There's two things that determine wards. Say you said them both.
Active Melchizedek priesthood holders that are full tithe payers, right. And the other one was something to do with welfare issues.
No, you got them there. It's Melchizedek priesthood holders and tithing payers. It's based on if you remember in the book, there's two standards, right? It's not church wide.
Isn't it one for Americans and one for every other country?
Yeah.
Right. Right.
And
that was surprising. I'd never heard that before. I thought that was really interesting.
Yeah, I thought so too.
Yeah, which begs the question: if you have to have X number of priesthood holders to have a ward in Kansas, why isn't it the same standard for Guatemala?
London.
Yeah. I guess that means the rest of the world is more righteous than the United States because they need less priesthood holders.
I guess so. they probably can't get as many.
It's probably just because there's so many here that you don't have to worry about that. It's
The current version says that the leader will normally invite the spouse of the married person to be present and give support when a calling is extended. The prior version said that the husband is normally invited when a wife is given a calling, but it doesn't say the other way around in the older one. So that this has been updated to be less misogynistic.
That's a change for the better, yeah. I think.
I thought so.
Yeah.
Yeah, I didn't notice a lot of changes. I went through kind of the index and looked for changes. between the two. They added some stuff on the perpetual education fund and some other clarity stuff. The only other real one that stuck out at me, maybe you picked up on some others, was the policy on excommunication for joining another church. In 1998, that was explicitly called out as not grounds for excommunication.
Which is kind of odd.
Yeah, the fact that you could go join another church and you wouldn't be able to be excommunicated for it. And in 2006, they changed that policy that is now grounds for excommunication.
That makes sense.
But you're still allowed a period for repentance. So if you join another church, you can repent and come back first.
Yes. And the other one that probably changed, although I only read it, maybe you all did, in the 1998 version on excommunication for name removal seemed to be out of date. Did you all look at the 2006 one?
I looked at 2006. What page was that again?
I did, yeah.
It's on page 88 of the 2006 on excommunication or name removal. And 1998 was still in the old world saying, you know, you really had to, people couldn't remove their name from the records of the church when they're in the process of getting excommunicated. Now, there is a rather famous, and I can't remember the name of the gentleman from down in Arizona who sued the church over that and won, or at least they settled out of court. There's another case not involving the Mormon church, involved another church where basically, it says in America, we have freedom of religion. And this is the Supreme Court, just to sum them up. And you voluntarily belong to organizations such as churches. And the minute you say, I am no longer a Mormon, you are no longer a Mormon. And so the idea that you can't drop your name from the church and that you have to be, excommunicated is illegal in the United States.
I remember reading that. That was, I think it was later. Was it on page 88? I think it was later on. That was some sticky stuff there. You don't even have to go through the excommunication process. You just tell them, I want my name off the records, remove it from the records, and that automatically does the excommunication. Is that correct? Because once your name's removed from the records, you lose all your ordinances.
Correct, but there are.
But you're not excommunicated.
No, they are different, and they have to be different, legally in the United States.
Being fired, and quitting.
Right,
but
now
I got you.
Now there are some things in here. One of the debates that's always come up is, you would think that removing your names from the records of the church means that your names were removed from the records of the church. The book makes clear that that's not the case. There is a section on annotations of the record. Zilpha, I know you had that earlier. You were reading to me. One of the keys, I can basically sum it up, is there are some secret annotations and notes that are put on people's records. Some of them say, call Salt Lake City. Some of them actually state on the records what your problem is. For example, and this is a really good one, if you have a record of molesting children, they will put an annotation on your records that says that you have a history of molesting children. If you are a homosexual, they will also put an annotation on your record saying that you are a homosexual. I don't quite understand that one.
That restricts you from callings. You can't have certain callings if these annotations are on your record.
Correct. The other implication is if your name has been removed from the records of the church, and the what it says in the book is if you were under church court, so okay, let's go through that scenario again. I'm about to be disfellowshipped, and I say, screw you guys, and I tell them to take the names off the records of the church. That's fine. Then I have a change of heart 3 years later, and I decide I want to be rebaptized. Well, according to the Handbook of Instruction, my records have a note on them that says I was in the process of being disfellowshipped. Now, the question is, how can my records have that annotation if I had my names removed? So, obviously, they do not remove anybody's names from the records of the church.
No, I think it's... Name removal, I mean, once you're in,
doesn't
you're
mean
in.
Name removal. It just means...
They flip a bit.
Means they... Yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
You're put in a different file or something.
Yeah.
You're still there.
Yeah. And the question is, how much do they track you and all that sort of stuff? And the answer is, I don't know. They probably keep you in some file somewhere. And whether or not they still count you as part of the 14 million, who knows?
Yeah, wait. This is exactly what it says.
Okay.
A request for name removal should be acted upon whether or not priesthood leaders suspect or have evidence of transgression. Any allegations or evidence of unresolved transgressions should be noted on the report of administrative action form, so priesthood leaders may resolve such matters in the future if the individual applies for readmission into the church. So they don't necessarily keep all of your records, but they do keep a report of administrative action form on you.
A record's a record.
Yeah, they do keep a record.
I'm pretty sure they keep the whole thing. They're not going to...
That's definitely changed, because in the older version, it has definitely changed from the old version, because the old version said that name removal should not be used if you can excommunicate somebody.
Correct.
So if someone can be excommunicated, or you feel that there's a reason to excommunicate them or impose church discipline, they weren't supposed to do your name removal, but I guess that's changed, which is good.
Yeah.
But you know, not everybody knows this, and this goes to the wide distribution. I got a letter from an individual just this last week, who was saying that they are in the process of getting excommunicated for apostasy. And they told their bishop they just wanted their name removed. And I mean, their stake president, it's a male, and their stake president said he can't do that. He has to be tried. And the stake president,
they haven't read this manual.
Stake president clearly doesn't know. And yeah, and you know, if you look on the boards, there's a lot of examples of, you just have to call up Salt Lake City and they will quickly call the stake president and tell him, no, you're off. Because like I said before, it is a matter of U.S. law that the church opens itself up for lawsuit if they proceed with an excommunication when a person tells them not to. Excommunication is a voluntary event for a voluntary organization.
You know, I remember when I went through my crisis of faith, I was a work clerk at the time. And one of the first things I did is I went back, opened book one and said, okay, if I tell them, what happens? And I went through and I read, you know, off, you know, all the conditions for apostasy and what they could do. And I knew the rules, and I said, okay, well, I'm fine. You know, I'm not aggressive. I'm not hostile. I'm not teaching heresies. You know, there's nothing they can do to me, even if I don't believe. And then I was able to, you know, be comfortable moving forward from there. But I had to check first because I was concerned, and there are differences. I mean, I knew my bishop didn't know all the rules in the book because I was constantly educating him on those matters.
Yeah. Are there other policies or procedures in the manuals that stuck out to you guys?
Oh, there's one that I think is also another new one. It's under the members who are not eligible for full-time missions.
Oh, yes, because they raised the bar.
They've raised the bar. And one thing that I don't think was in the older one, but correct me if I'm wrong, was that if... either the males or females have fathered or mothered a child out of wedlock and then placed them for adoption, they are not eligible to serve a mission. And maybe that's not new. Maybe I just was not aware of that. So, you know, if a teenager, 15, 16-year-old, gets pregnant, places the baby for adoption like the church recommends, those parents would not be eligible to serve a mission.
Or, I mean, let's be clear on that policy. If I'm a 16-year-old and I have sex with my girlfriend, and then I repent, I go to the bishop and repent, I can go on a mission when I'm 19. If I have sex with the same girl doing the exact same action and she happens to conceive, I'm no longer eligible for a mission, right?
I think there's probably an exception, because my sister was divorced, and divorced people aren't supposed to go on missions, but she got some sort of special permission from the area president, I think, to turn in papers anyway.
Wow.
Huh. Well, there are exceptions out there. But you're right, Zilpha, the raising the bar policies, which is things like if you've had multiple...
I think it's the first presidency exceptions.
Yeah. There's always the first pregnancy exception. But if you've had multiple sexual partners or had a long-term sexual relationship, or you had any homosexual activities after the age of 15, after the age of 16, wasn't it, Zilpha? It was if you had homosexual activity in the last three teenage years, which would be 19, 18, and 17, you are not allowed to go on a mission. But I guess if you were a homosexual when you're 15, you can get an exception.
You can't go if you're HIV positive or if you're significantly overweight.
Yes. No fatties.
I do have to say that the ones I was naming, it does say that they're not normally recommended to serve full-time missions. So it's not never. It's they're not normally recommended. So if you've had an abortion, you've given your child up for adoption, you've been divorced, or you're overweight, those, I guess you have to have special permission, but they're normally not recommended.
Well, we haven't talked about the one thing in the book that whenever discussions of the book come up gets cited most often, which is vasectomies. The reason I think vasectomies are funny is it's because one of those areas of the church where the general membership is in rebellion against the Church Handbook of Instructions. The Church Handbook of Instructions uses the language, Zilpha, do you have it there, the language on vasectomies? The church strongly discourages vasectomies.
It says the church, yeah, you got it just right. The church strongly discourages surgical sterilization as an elective form of birth control.
But vasectomies are becoming very common in the church. But this is one of those things that maybe if they distributed the book, everybody would stop getting the snip snip, you know?
Or we'd find the book changed in the next edition.
Yeah.
And that means tubals too. And I used to work on the hospital ward, and I can tell you that it wasn't, I mean, there were definitely members getting tubals quite frequently.
I would dare say that today, in 2010.
You know, tying of the tubes.
If you went to any ward and polled members above the age of 45, I would dare say the majority either of the have a vasectomy or a tubal ligation. Easily the majority.
Goes in hand with it. You're not allowed to donate sperm either.
Yeah.
Yes, that was strongly discouraged also. But it explicitly it says that it is a decision of the couple.
Yes. So a surrogate motherhood.
So
that one doesn't. The donation of sperm is not given to the couple. It's just strongly discouraged. But using somebody else's semen is to be left as a matter of the couple to decide, even though it's strongly discouraged.
But they're not. The church isn't happy about it. But they'll let you do it as long as you feel really strongly about it.
Don't have any pray. Church discipline laid out here, ready to meet you.
Yeah, it does raise an interesting question. What exactly in the Mormon paradigm does it mean to have a strongly discouraged action by the church? Does that mean it's immoral? Mike, maybe you can take a stab at that. What does it mean to have the Mormon church strongly discourage something?
The church does not interfere with your free agency.
I understand that.
But a lot of strongly discouraged means God doesn't think it's right, but they're not going to interfere with your free agency.
So carte blanche, if it says in the handbook of instruction, God, that an action's discouraged, that God thinks it's wrong. That's what they're saying.
That is my personal opinion, yes.
I don't see how you could interpret it any other way. I think you're right.
I think there's another section. There's another portion that's really interesting. Under abortion, the last line of that, I find very interesting here, as opposed to saying it's strongly discouraged because it's a bigger deal, they say, as far as has been revealed, a person may repent and be forgiven for the sin of abortion, which I see as kind of a big question mark saying, maybe it's unforgivable, we don't know, so go ahead and try to repent anyway. But it's leaving it open so that later they can come and say, nope, I'm sorry, that is actually unforgivable, you committed murder. They're very wishy-washy on something that you should be a little more precise in, I think.
Yeah, and they actually state right out that there is no direct revelation on when the spirit enters the body. So they don't know when the spirit enters the body. It could be just right at birth, as far as they know.
I think it's a good thing. That'd be a good question for the first presidency to take before the Lord. Let's figure this one out so we don't have to be worried about this so much.
Yeah, sure.
That'd be a good one.
I don't think the church has ever made it clear when the spirit enters, but it is fascinating that this is one of the few instances of the book that uses language like that, where it says
that there's no direct revelation.
Yeah, we don't know. And of course, fascinating in here is the church's position on abortion, which probably deserves an entire podcast. But Zilpha, do you have it in front of you there?
No, but I think Gail does. Gail, do you have
Yeah, I do. Which part did you want to hear about?
Well, the most interesting one is the one on rape and incest. But how long is the passage on abortion?
It's about half a column. I could read it in a couple minutes.
All right, go ahead. Why don't you read it?
All right, abortion. This is under policies on moral issues. Abortion. The Lord commanded, thou shalt not kill, nor do anything like unto it. DC 59:6. The church opposes elective abortion for personal or social convenience. Members must not submit to, perform, pay for, arrange for, or encourage an abortion. The only possible exemptions are when, 1, pregnancy results from rape or incest, 2, a competent physician determines that the life or health of the mother is in serious jeopardy, 3, a competent physician determines that the fetus has severe defects that will not allow the baby to survive beyond birth. Even these exemptions do not justify abortion automatically. Abortion is a most serious matter and should be considered only after the persons responsible have consulted with their bishops and received divine confirmation through prayer.
Okay.
The church has not favored or opposed legislative proposals or public demonstrations concerning abortion. However, the First Presidency encourages members as citizens to let their voices be heard in appropriate and legal ways that will evidence their belief in the sacredness of life. Church members who submit to, perform, pay for, arrange for, or encourage an abortion may be subject to church discipline. And then there's that line, as far as has been revealed, a person may repent and be forgiven for the sin of abortion.
Now, the reason I want to highlight this is of the conservative world out there, which, you know, Utahns and the church is usually pretty far up there. This is a fairly liberal position on abortion on several fronts. And it's quite nuanced, and I think, although I don't agree with it, I think it's actually fairly well written.
Yeah.
Mike?
Yeah, it's a lot more liberal than other churches. More liberal than the Catholic Church, for instance.
Yeah, it makes a lot more sense than just saying carte blanche, no abortions. Because they're giving an allowance for special circumstances that, you know, obviously, an abortion would be inappropriate.
I like that they have some exemptions listed.
Yeah.
But they're also clear that it's not means these are, you know, it's just a free license, go ahead, as long as any of these apply. It's like, you know, okay, maybe it's appropriate. Give it some consideration, though. Don't just rush in and assume it's okay.
Yeah, I think the real tangle there is rape.
I think being very tentative is probably the best approach to abortion.
Yeah.
You know, if you think that abortion is murder, you're not going to make any exception for rape. So that makes the church's position fairly complicated. And I think we'll probably have to explore that one a little bit further.
I definitely wanted to bring out their sections on the new age kind of health group. Help, self-help. What do they call it specifically? I didn't print out the whole thing.
They called it self-awareness groups.
Yeah, and your church members should not participate in groups that challenge religious or moral values or advocate unwarranted confrontation with spouse or family members as a means of reaching one's potential, and they shouldn't. The groups should not foster physical contact among participants, and they shouldn't meet late into the evening or in the early morning hours. So that would rule out seminary, right?
I wish.
Oh, yeah, and you can't be paired with another person's spouse in those groups. I don't know what people were getting involved with. But
yeah, as I read through this, you know, the question always was, I wonder what spawned this one. You know, like, for example, there was some stuff on the occult, which I think clearly came out of the occult scare that happened in the late 80s, you know, with Bishop Glenn Pace and those guys. That's probably a story we can go into on another podcast. But, you know, some of these things, I know the stories behind some interaction with polygamous groups. But there's others that say, I wonder what spawned that policy. But all right, guys, we've sort of given a good overview of the Handbook of Instructions. Any last thoughts on the book?
I just wanted to... Go ahead.
There should be a sin rubric.
A sin rubric?
Yes, because different bishops punish people or impose church discipline in different ways, and it kind of is luck of the draw depending on who your bishop is. So, you know, spell it out for them.
Yeah, I agree. I use a personal example. I won't say who it is, but somebody I'm well acquainted with was ordained a deacon, never went to church much after that. At 18, he was living with his girlfriend in a monogamous relationship. They were unmarried. They later became married. They still together about 20 years later. His bishop, as an 18-year-old deacon, excommunicated him. Where I know personally people who I serve missions with who had had sex with multiple women who were out on their mission and serving faithfully. So I think you're absolutely right. I think that church discipline, especially in sexual matters, is put out. I shouldn't use the word put out with sexual matters. The church discipline with sex is not administered equally. And that's unfortunately still missing from the book. And I think that would be valuable to say, you know, these sort of things warrant disfellowship and these things warrant excommunication. I agree 100%.
Yeah. Because I think a lot of people suffer because of, you know, bishops saying, you know, some bishops will just shrug it off and some bishops say, oh, you need to wait a year before you get married or before you go on a mission. And that's just not fair.
Yeah, I agree.
Well, I wanted to do one little shout out to something that we had on another podcast with Will Bagley.
You're not going to talk about what I think you're talking
about.
Oh, no. No, all I'm going to say is that in the youth interviews section, it specifically says that the leader should not arouse curiosity or experimentation with their questions. So that bishop was out of line.
You know, I have a funny story.
Well said, Zilpha.
When I was about 13, we had a special kind of fireside for the boys. And this guy was talking about, I can't even remember the talk. He was talking about pipes and pressure. And the whole thing was, I think now, a metaphor for masturbation. At 13, I sat there through that whole thing. And I had no idea what that guy was talking about the whole time. And it was this complicated sort of
cleaning the pipes.
Yeah, I can't even remember all the stuff he said, but I mean, it goes to that point where I think that's happened more than once, where the bishop has asked questions and people were like, "I didn't know you could do that."
I want to call to attention on page 116, where it talks about excommunicating members. It talks about choose a right time after all this has gone on to talk to them about getting their address and retaining his name on the record so that they continue to assist him. Because it spells out there that an excommunication and church discipline is all there in an effort to help the person in repentance and getting closer to Christ. As ugly as church discipline is and hurt feelings involved, the whole thing is actually out of genuine love and concern for the person to help them draw closer to God.
I think
the idea behind it.
Yeah, I think that's ideal. And I think if the church is doing it right, that's now I of course have not made any pretense. I think excommunication is silly and medieval, but if they're going to do it, they should do it in full cooperation of the individual. So I think that's good advice.
Yeah, I just want to point that out. That it is something that you keep in contact with the next community member and work with them and try and get them to come back and get rebaptized. And
yeah, if they're open to the idea.
All right, everybody. Well, thanks. I think it's been an interesting discussion. I recommend that everybody go out there. You know, I don't want to tell you where on the WikiLeaks page it would be for fear of telling you where to link to the document, but it's a fascinating read, and every member of the church should read through the Handbook of Instruction.
Absolutely.
All right. As always, the discussion continues on MormonExpression.com, where you are welcome to come and post a synopsis of your favorite passage from the Church Handbook of Instruction or any other thoughts you have on this podcast. You can send us an email at mail@MormonExpression.com, or you can call us as soon as I find the number at our number 801.
Come on, John.
My computer's slow.
Oh, they don't call the number anyway.
No, they don't. Or you can call us at our number at 801-906-6722.